Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for home theater geeks is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, recorded January 23rd, 2012. Episode 96, Captain 3D. This episode of Home Theater Geeks is brought to you by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your PC, Mac, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly. All stream directly to you, saving you time, money, and hassle. For your free 30-day trial, go to netflix.com/twit. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here, online editor of hometheater.com. My guest geek this week is Phil Captain 3D McNally, a supervising stereographer at DreamWorks Animation with a deep interest and knowledge of 3D. Hey, Phil, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Scott. It's nice to be here.
Now, your title is supervising stereographer. Is that correct?
That's right. Yeah, something like that. Close enough. You know, with 3D at the studio, I'm the person responsible.
You're the go-to guy. I want to say before we get started that those of you who are watching live at live.twit.tv or logged into the chat room at irc.twit.tv can post questions for Phil, and I'll pass along as many as I can. Now, obviously, the subject today is 3D. In fact, Phil, you actually, if I'm not mistaken, had your middle name legally set to Captain 3D. Is that right?
That's right. You know, it all started back about 15 years ago or something when somebody wrote me a check to Captain 3D when I was doing some work for them. And it's kind of stuck there for a long time, but I actually became an American citizen at the end of last year. And I'm pleased to say I am officially Captain 3D on my American passport now. That's my middle name. You know, they can't do numbers though, you know, so I'm Captain the Third D.
All right. Well, how did you get started? How did you become interested in 3D and to get to the point where you are now Captain 3D?
Well, you know, I think like most people, I had some experience with a ViewMaster type 3D system when I was very young. And in fact, my friend Ian Franklin at school, I would have been about 13, he had brought in this 3D viewer of World War II pictures. Now, I didn't really know what 3D or stereoscopic photography was at that point, but I was just looking at black and white pictures because someone else had the viewer. And I remember kind of being somewhat dismissive, you know, of like, oh, it's just old pictures. And then I got my chance with the viewer. And when I put the pictures into the viewer and I saw, you know, it spatially for the first time, what amazed me was how I felt it was no longer just some distant black and white thing that didn't apply to me. I really felt like I was in that moment and they were real people in a real space. And, you know, fast forward to college years, I had a chance to do some holography. This was at the Royal College of Art in London. And as part of that class, I was actually doing furniture design at the time. But as part of this kind of one-off class in holography, stereoscopic vision came up. And that reminded me of the pictures. And then I realized I could put my own cameras together and make my own stereoscopic pictures. And that was 1991. And I kind of got hooked from there. And that was the end of any furniture design career that might have happened.
Multi-dollar in the chat room is asking, where can one learn to be a stereographer?
You know, I think one of the best places to learn, and this is certainly how I learned, is through stereo photography clubs. And
Of which there are many. I know of several in the United States.
There are many. So the one in Los Angeles area is the LA 3D Club, and there's a National Stereoscopic Association, which is the NSA, which might entertain you. But, you know, if you go and look at their websites for the National Stereoscopic Association, and pretty quickly you'll find some links to find a local club. And really, there are people who've been shooting stereo for, you know, years and years, since the 50s sometimes, and have a huge amount of knowledge. And there's a very good couple of Yahoo groups as well. Photo 3D is one, and 3D TV is another one, which is more biased towards video. or movies.
Right, exactly. I got somebody else in the chat room asking, so did you work on How to Train Your Dragon?
I did work on How to Train Your Dragon. Actually, one of my favorite movies that I've worked on. So the cinematographer in an animated movie, we call the head of layout because it came from the days of, you know, drawing. Gil Zimmerman was the head of layout or the cinematographer for that movie. Mm-hmm. And we had a great working relationship on the show, talking about how the stereo can enhance the story and how it can work with his camera plans. Because really, it should be one person who's the camera and stereo and composition. It should all be one thing. But, you know, the skills are divided at the moment. So we work as a partnership. And it was a great time with Gil on that movie.
Yeah. Well, we're going to talk a lot more about the movies that you've worked on in a bit. But I was reminded when you spoke a moment ago about how people have been doing 3D for years and years and years, that 3D as a format for movies anyway has sort of come and gone several times. You know, we had a big surge in the 50s, maybe a little bit smaller one in the 70s, I think. And now here we are again. Do you think that 3D will go like it did in the past, or is it here to stay? And if so, what makes this time different?
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously something which I've experienced myself that it's come and gone. And I've always been interested in my, you know, own sort of hobby side, which has become my profession. I think two ways I look at it. If 3D was so bad, why does it keep coming back? You know, of course, it keeps coming.
Good point.
It keeps coming back because we see in 3D. It's very natural that, you know, we see in color. We ultimately end up with color imaging. You know, we see in stereo, we'll ultimately end up in stereo imaging. Now, the only question is the technology good enough today, or will it have to develop further? So that's a question which really does come down to personal preference, but we do seem to have got past the point that no other attempt at a 3D cinema certainly has got to before. So I think you just have to accept that 3D visuals will be part of the future. The only question is the technology good enough at this point? And I think it probably is. So,
Perhaps because digital projection, is that one key element?
It is. I mean, really, if you think back, and you're right in saying it's been around for a long time, many people have experienced, you know, stereo viewers from the 1800s, you know, very old
exactly.
pictures. Some amazing stuff back there in history. But
stereo opticons, I think they were called.
Yeah. And I think even the first stereo movie, Raison would correct me, but I hope I get it right. It was The Power of Love, I think was 1922. Mm. And, you know, so even moving images in stereo have been around for a long time. So I think the question is, why has it been such a huge success this time around? And what's always been difficult in the past, as you can imagine, you know, two pieces of film, or if it's Technicolor, you know, how many strips of film was in Technicolor, you know, double that. And they were shooting stereo back then, but alignment of lenses, pieces of film, having to realign that in the edit, also in projection, all of these things were very difficult to control in an analog world. And so when digital came along, the digital, not only projection, but in our case, you know, construction, you know, we make the movies digitally. We edit them, we finish them in digital, they get projected digitally. So literally, every pixel that we render ends up in exactly the right place on the screen. Slightly different for live action, because they're using real lenses, whereas we use computer, you know, calculations, really. But digital projection has meant the precision that's required for comfortable stereo is now possible, and that's really been the big difference.
Yeah, somebody in the chat room was saying, you know, if 3D was so good in the past, why does it keep going away? And I think you've just answered that question, which is that the technology simply wasn't there to make it as comfortable an experience as it is today.
Yeah. And, you know, some people aren't comfortable with it. So it's, you know, it's not 100%. It's up to us to really make good quality content, which doesn't hurt people and that gives them enjoyment, you know.
Well, so, that was certainly another question I wanted to ask about was that, even today, there are plenty of people who complain about getting dizzy or nauseous when watching 3D, getting a headache at least. Is that something that can ever be wholly avoided or gotten around, or is that always going to be that some people are going to experience that?
It's true. Some people will always feel some of that. Like, I know my parents would not enjoy a lot of fast cut action movies because it would be too loud and it would make them feel sick. So, yeah. You know, yeah. There's a level of interest that we're prepared to accept. And, you know, so stereo is in the same category. Now, how many people genuinely can't watch stereo? It is a very small percentage because of, you know, they literally can only see from one eye, for example, or something like that.
Right.
It's just a few percent. But maybe there's up to 10% of people who have some kind of discomfort. And what's important for us as filmmakers is to, content makers, is to really make sure that the control that we have is used to make it comfortable, and that we have to understand that some stereo settings are uncomfortable and other ones are comfortable. So it's important that we work within the palette, which is comfortable right now, until, I don't know, some future other version comes up. I mean, real life, of course, is not a stereoscopic image, if that makes, that's a bit confusing. But I mean, in real life, it's real objects. So if I tilt my head this way or that way or whichever way I look, the real world is giving me perfect aligned light coming back to my eyes.
Right, right. In fact, we should make a distinction. I've often heard it said that we should make a distinction in, between real life 3D, that is looking out into the real world, versus stereoscopic imaging, such as we see in movie theaters and TVs now, and the stereo opticon and the ViewMaster and so on, which is simulated 3D, but call it stereoscopic as opposed to genuine 3D. Would you agree?
I would agree. So if you think of just in the 2D analogy between real life viewing, you know, I can look around in any direction, but in the cinema, we're only presented a specific point of view, you know, obviously decided by the director or cinematographer. For 3D, it's kind of the same. I can see 3D all the way from, you know, my hand this close all the way out to the mountains in real life. I can, like I said, I can tilt my head, I can look anywhere. But in the cinema, we have to present a specific view of 3D. And so even tilting your head in the cinema will start to make your eyes misalign. So although obviously we are quite flexible in what we can do, it still means that the stereoscopic cinema is a very narrow selection of what 3D would be in real life. And so it's very specifically designed point of view, a left
not
eye
only that,
and
but
a right eye.
Right. I've also heard it said that, you know, unlike the real world where you can focus near or focus far, as you said, with the movies, the filmmaker is choosing for you what is in focus and what is out of focus.
Actually, that's a good point. And so if you think about in real life, obviously when I look at my hand here in real life, I'm not only converging my eyes on this point, which is close, but mm-hmm. my lenses are literally focusing just 10 inches or 12 inches away as well. Mm-hmm. If I tried to recreate that in the theater and I made a hand float out so it's just 12 inches in front of my face, it's possible. But of course, my lens still has to focus all the way back on the screen to keep the image sharp because it's not really in space. So
right.
Under extreme situations, you then disconnect the focus and where your eyes are actually pointing. They get separated. And that's not something that we're, you know, we're not doing that in real life. The good news is you don't have to literally focus on the screen because our eyes have their own natural depth of field, which gives us quite a broad range either side of the screen that we're allowed to work with as a stereo filmmaker, which remains comfortable. So from the screen all the way out to infinity, and from the screen forwards to about maybe within 10 feet of someone sitting in the audience on a 40-foot screen type of cinema is kind of our depth budget that we can work within.
Mm. You're reminding me of something that, who was it? Walter Murch, I think, said that this was one reason why perhaps people had discomfort looking at 3D was that their focus was actually on the screen distance at all times, whereas the convergence was different depending on whether the object was simulated in front of the screen or behind the screen. Do you remember those comments?
Yes, I do. And I used to believe the same thing, that you're precisely focused on the screen, let's say at 40 feet away. And so mm-hmm. if something appears only 20 feet away, that's eye strain potential. But it turns out not to be the case. So there's actually a misunderstanding that we're not absolutely locked. There's actually a range of depth where you do not need to refocus to be able to experience the depth. And actually right now we're working, some people might have seen an eye tracking demonstration from There Will Be Blood. It was online a while ago where it was tracking the audience's eyes as to where they look, just 2D, obviously, 2D movie, but just eye tracking to see where's their point of attention around in the scene. And the professor who did that work is from England, called Tim Smith, and he came to visit the studio, and we've just got a report from Tim, in fact, talking exactly about convergence versus accommodation, you know, focus and where you look. And so it's been confirmed through several studies now that there's a range within which you do not need to refocus. And then outside of that range, it does genuinely become detached between convergence and focus. Now, you can still do it if you're careful, or you can use it for extreme moments in the movie, or you can use it to shock people and, you know, unbalance them. But there's actually a very broad range, like I said, from about 10 feet to infinity. And people can test this themselves if they're if they look at something and they close one eye, if they can look out a window, if you can look at something that's 10 feet and also be aware of the thing which is, you know, out there in the distance, you'll notice that your focus doesn't really change when you look between them with one eye. Everything appears sharp, but it's about 10 feet to infinity. And another example of this, actually, my mum, you know, she's getting a little older, and unfortunately she had to, you know, have an eye operation for cataracts, which is very common now. And she has her lens replaced with a lens which is fixed focus. Now, she no longer has the ability to focus her eye, but she sees everything from about 5 feet to infinity, pin sharp now. So no focus at all. So she should be perfect for 3D movies, I would have thought.
So all you cataract patients out there.
Now, brightness is an issue, because obviously a small pupil will be sharper and a very wide open pupil will be less sharp. So we definitely want brightness in the theaters to improve. And that's something that has been a bit disappointing.
Which is exactly one of the main problems of stereoscopic movies, is that the brightness is so low typically, which is why I typically go to IMAX 3D, because they use two projectors.
There's several systems out there. Yes, you're right. IMAX has two projectors. And so that doubles the amount of light, which is, you know, coming back from the screen. Real D also has a system called an XL filter, or I'm not sure what their public name is for it now. But anyway, it also has done great work on doubling the amount of light which has been available. We're slightly up against the problem, though, that not at IMAX so much, but at other theaters, the tendency is to turn the bulb brightness down because, you know, it uses a lot of electricity. And so the theaters tend to turn the bulb down to conserve, you know, hundreds and thousands of dollars worth of bulbs every year at the expense of brightness.
Plus, they don't have to replace them as often then as well, would be another reason to do that.
But it is true to say that typically, if you take the SMPTE standards for cinema projection, you know, the 2D standard, I think, is 14, maybe it's 16, but anyway, 14 or 16.
I think it's 16 foot Lamberts.
16. So 16 foot Lamberts. A good 3D system right now is probably more in the 4 to 5 range. So it's, you know, it's considerably less. Now we
like
actually
25%,
work,
yeah.
Now we work incredibly hard at DreamWorks here, at DreamWorks Animation, to color time our movie, which means, you know, adjusting the brightness, the colors, all of those, to actually boost the brightness within the content before it goes to the cinema. So I often read comments, you know, if you tip up your glasses in the 3D movie and you see how bright and vivid the colors are, that's what you're missing. Actually, that's not true, because what you're seeing is an exaggerated saturation and an exaggerated brightness in the content to compensate as best we can for a lack of brightness in the bulb. So we actually get our movies visually very close to each other between the 2D version unadjusted, apart from the creative decisions, of course, and the 3D version with these extra 3D boost, which is built into the design of the 3D movie. So they're not the same and take
Yeah, if you looked at the 2D version and the 3D version next to each other without the glasses, they would in fact look different.
They would look considerably different, 30% brighter and more saturated, something like that.
Mm-hmm. So taking your glasses off during the movie is not recommended.
It's not, unless you need to go to the bathroom, otherwise you look stupid.
Well, yes, of course. Well, we've got a couple of questions here about the future of 3D. The Brady Report is asking, do you think light field photography, this new type of photography you've probably heard of, which lets you choose where your depth of field is, where your focus is after you've taken the picture, will that have any impact on the future of 3D?
I think it will. I mean, the camera, I've forgotten the name, I'm sure you'll remind me, Scott, that came out at Christmas, you know, the little square one.
Yeah. Lytros, something like that.
Yes. So that one actually does have some 3D capability built in, although the depth is quite shallow. Not the depth of field, but, you know, the actual stereoscopic depth. So because you're capturing an array of images, for focus purposes primarily, but because you have something which is more to the left and more to the right, there's stereoscopic data there as well. So yeah, I think
Lytro, I'm being told, is what the answer is.
Lytro.
Yeah.
So, but if you look at their website, you will see some stereoscopic examples, which is good for very close up, smaller things. And so I think ultimately, and one of my fellow stereographers, Tim Sassoon, not at DreamWorks, he runs his own company, Sassoon Film Design. Tim Sassoon has talked quite a lot on some of the kind of professional forums for stereo about the idea that future filmmaking will likely be just capturing the data that you then set the stereo or set the focus later on in post-production. Mm. Similar in a way to motion capture right now, but with real actors. And that makes a lot of sense to me, that you would be able to, you know, capture the data of the scene, albeit from the point of view that you're trying to tell your story, but still more capturing a broader range of data so that you have the ability to get it right later on. Because if you think of color, you know, in the past, everything had to be done directly, you know, on film. But even movies shot on film, which is still, you know, the majority, I think. But even movies shot on film, they all go through, almost all of them go through a digital intermediate stage where the film is scanned, all the work like compositing and lighting and lighting effects and things like that are done in a digital environment. And then it may go back out to film. But the point is, there's a digital part to any film production. And nobody, I think, these days would go on set expecting to get the color right as they shoot. So why you would expect to get the stereo right as you shoot is similar kind of question. Now, of course, we do still expect to get the framing correct to a certain degree. But, you know, we think about The Hobbit at the moment is out shooting, I believe, 5K with the red cameras.
Right.
Which gives them a certain amount of extra image that they can then crop in and move around within that a little bit in post. So I think more and more we'll end up in post-production, and on-set will be more about capturing as much data as possible.
Now, I've got a number of people in the chat room saying how much they hate 3D, and this was a question I wanted to ask you, because 3D sparks very strong feelings, both pro and con, the pros don't seem to speak up quite as much as the cons. But this is somewhat unlike other technologies. You know, everybody wants 4K, for example, you know, and everybody loves color TV over black and white, I would say, except for maybe black and white movies. But aside from that, 3D seems to have this very strong polarization element. Why do you suppose that is?
Well, I mean, I'd like to propose something first, that everyone who hates 3D, make sure they poke out one eye, because they must be having a terrible time every day seeing everything in depth. So what they really mean is they don't like the current version, maybe, of stereoscopic or something. So it's
once
not
again,
like
we get back to the distinction between real 3D and stereoscopic imagery.
I think so, because, I mean, obviously there's a few people who literally can't see out of one eye. We're not talking about those people. We're talking about people who see correctly, but say they hate 3D, but clearly right. they enjoy spatial viewing in their real life. Right. So that's why I get back to that point of, in the future, 3D will be there. It's just whether or not the current technology is good enough. So I think for the majority of people, it's good enough. And you get a certain amount, and you know, Roger Ebert would certainly be one, I think,
yes.
who love the art of two-dimensional filmmaking. And it genuinely is an art of two dimensions, which does not represent the reality of 3D viewing in real life. And so adding 3D stereo to a 2D movie can produce a result that I could imagine people hate, because it's like saying, here's this painting which I love, and someone has now converted it into a sculpture. That's not the experience I want. I want to see a painting. But I think what we need to do is work out, one, how do we continue to improve the technology all the time, of course, and two, how do you deliver a spatial storytelling experience, like the theater, maybe, but a spatial yeah. storytelling experience that you genuinely enjoy because it's a spatial experience, and you wouldn't even start to imagine it as a 2D movie. That's where we need to get to. Then everyone mm-hmm. will love the 3D for being 3D, and they will love the 2D for being 2D.
Well, and here's this brings up another question that F-Loop in the chat room has asked. Philly Darts. Which has to do with converting 2D movies. Because as we know, George Lucas has converted Star Wars Episode One. It's due out next month in sure. 3D. James Cameron is converting Titanic to 3D. And I know Roger Ebert objects to this strenuously. Yeah. I've often asked the question myself, after Clash of the Titans, for example, is it right. possible to do a good job of converting a 2D movie into 3D?
Yes, it certainly is. It's difficult, but it's possible. So if you are looking at archive material, you know, Titanic wasn't shot in 3D.
Right.
And so it wasn't necessarily planned to be a spatial movie. But I know the small amount that I've seen of the Titanic tests of the conversion, admittedly quite old now, but they were really very, very good. They were excellent 3D. And so it's more a matter of what your intention is when you do it. You know, did you shoot the movie to benefit from a spatial style of filmmaking? And then how are you artistically judging the 3D of the conversion? Like, is there someone skilled who's really there as the creative lead for that? I think often in some of the more recent ones, and the one you mentioned was in my mind. But, you know, there was a lot of this. The movie is done and some other person has made a decision to send it off somewhere and then come back as a 3D version without yeah. the original filmmakers artistically involved. Now, I think I'm sure Star Wars will have a lot of involvement by a lot of creative people. I think John Knoll up at ILM is actually responsible for keeping check on everything. And certainly Cameron and Titanic is probably beating everyone to death to, to get the result that he wants. So I'm sure that's a very challenging project, but I bet he does a good job of it. Where it gets really difficult is when you're close up on a face and our brains are very, very tuned to something being not quite right, and that's where it gets difficult. But if you're prepared to put in the time and work, conversion can do great work. And, you know, but to counter that, you can do really bad work by capturing real-life 3D, real-life stereoscopic 3D, I should say, with bad camera work or bad camera decisions, and you could do excellent work with conversion. And the reality is, if you think back to my analogy of you capture a certain amount of color and light on set, but in post-production you tweak it until you get it just right and how you want it creatively. I think it will be something similar, that conversion techniques are very similar to how color conversion techniques started. You know, you would have a black and white film, you'd add color and you'd tweak things, but of course every movie has color conversion going on now. we don't expect the colors of a movie to be captured like real life. They're creatively directed. And so conversion techniques will similarly be used in the future to adjust the captured stereo, to tweak it into exactly what you have or what you want creatively. Mm-hmm.
You've been talking some about capturing live action 3D, and you yourself work mostly or exclusively on animated 3D. I wonder what the difference is there. Most of the 3D movies that have been released so far, I think, have been animated. Is it more difficult to capture live action 3D?
I mean, live action filmmaking is more difficult in general, I think. I mean, you have the fact that you have to get it live, obviously, whereas in animation, everything happens in very slow motion. The downside of animation, of course, is that you don't get anything for free. You know, if you want a blade of grass, someone has to go to the modeling department and get someone to model a blade of grass for them, you know? So nothing comes for free. It's just a blank slate. But once you've built it and you have your dimensional space inside, in our case, you know, something like Maya animation software, then you have full control over that world. And motion capture is something similar. I can see why the directors have got to like that idea.
For example, Adventures of Tintin, I believe, was a lot of motion capture. And I thought the 3D on that looked fabulous.
Yeah, because it's really a very similar situation to where we are with animation. Total control.
Right, exactly.
So I think when you think back, though, and actually think of capturing live action, you're up against the real world. You know, you have cameras which have to align and they have to shoot the correct thing, and you have lenses with real bits of glass in that have certain amounts of distortion. And something that's very common and different between what we can do in animation and live action is lens choice. So if in a live action set you want to get close to the actor, it's typically done by using a longer lens rather than by pushing the camera in, because, you know, cameras on live action sets are very big, even though you know, digital has made it smaller. But if you're using a wide-angle lens and you want to have a close-up, you end up with a camera which is, you know, right in here by the face of the actor, which is not very good for lighting, you know.
Right,
and so it's
right.
quite typical to back the camera off and be more remote and then use the lens to zoom in to get closer. And that's led us to that very kind of classic long lens close-up where you have the person sharp and the background is completely out of focus and the foreground is very out of focus. So maybe that's a 70 or 80 or 100 millimeter lens type of shot. Mm-hmm. That's not very good for 3D. Wide angle lenses are actually better for 3D. And if you think about it, the viewing experience in the theater is a wide angle shape. You know, if you imagined lines going from your from your eyes out to the corners of the screen, it's like a pyramid, which is quite a wide angle pyramid. And the typical center seat in most theaters actually come up with a field of view which matches our 28 millimeter lens in our world on a it's called a super 35 millimeter film back. So if you capture a scene using that same field of view, it fits very comfortably into the theater, but it also gives you nice full roundness, so a character's head looks like it's nice and round. If you use a long lens, you can imagine the shape of a long lens is actually a much narrower field of view. So it's like you're capturing a space that's very long and deep, but thin. And then you take that and you put it into the theater. You've kind of reshaped into a much flatter in depth and wider field of view. And that's why you get this look of a cardboard cutout person over a flat background, which is out of focus.
I never understood that before. That's very good.
Yeah, so it's the long lens, which is typically used in live action to bring characters closer together, ironically, actually needs a lot more depth to show the volume and roundness of a head correctly. So for us, our prime lenses for making good 3D is somewhere between a 24 millimeter up to maybe a 32 millimeter. But for a live action set, if you said, you know, do a close-up, even with a 32 millimeter, that would be seen as, you know, quite a wide angle lens for a framing kind of as on myself right now. Having said that, I'm on an iPod Touch right now. That's probably quite a wide angle lens. So you can see a little bit of wide angle distortion to my face.
Right.
And, you know, that isn't recognized as, I mean, that is recognized as not being a good look for your main actress. And that longer lens, you know, that 50 millimeter and higher is geometrically a much nicer looking lens. So I can understand why. And of course, if it's a, you know, if it's something like a action sequence and it's, you know, it's very difficult to move a camera quickly with someone, it's much easier to use a long lens and, you know, follow them through the framing. And that's become the language of 2D cinema, which, of course, we've all grown to love as a style, to the point that sometimes we don't recognize that it's different from real life. But I assure you, looking with a long lens at action and following it around has nothing to do with real life. But it's great movies.
Yeah, exactly. I do want to point out that to people that those of you who are watching the video that Phil is on an iPod Touch, as he said,
That's right.
With Skype. So that's kind of cool, actually. I think you're my first iPod Touch guest.
You know, really, we did it because it was, we all use Linux computers here at the studio. And like, does Skype run on Linux? I'm sure it does. But, you know, by the time we'd go through the red tape of getting someone from technology to install Skype, we thought, you know, why don't I just use the guest network and try it? And hopefully, yeah, if we get a chance, we might get a moment to, it's a rainy day, but we might get a moment to walk outside. I could show you a little bit of the campus if our connection
sure,
holds
sure.
up.
No, I'd love to. Before we do, though, I would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor for this episode, which is Netflix. Netflix, of course, as virtually all of our viewers know, streams thousands of TV shows and movies directly to your computer on just about any device, including iPods, iPhones, iPads, Blu-ray players, TVs, computers, game consoles. Just about everything has a Netflix app and lets you stream tons of stuff directly to your TV, saving you time, money, and hassle. And you can watch them instantly. You can start on one device and on another device. It's very flexible, very easy. And just really an excellent way to find content that you wouldn't otherwise normally find easily anyway. I've been watching Michael Palin's New Europe series, which is about the Eastern European countries now joining the EU. And it's absolutely fascinating. And I don't think I would have found it otherwise. For our TWIT listeners, Netflix is offering a 30-day free trial. All you have to do is go to netflix.com/twit and be sure to use that URL when you're signing up for your free trial, netflix.com/twit. And we thank Netflix for their support of this show and the entire TWIT network. Now, Phil, talking about Netflix makes me wonder, do you know of any 3D streaming that's going on yet, or has that not yet been tried? Or I'm sure it's been tried, but I'm not sure it's really commercially available yet.
It's a good point about streaming. I know there are several networks which are doing 3D content, you know, ESPN, 3net, in Sky in the UK. So there is content out there, but as to streaming, it's a good point. I don't actually know. I'll have to look and search.
Look and see. Yeah, I'm going to have to look. I'm going to have to look as well. Let's see. I had another couple of questions here for you.
Sure.
I know. The interest in 3D, in current 3D presentations, it was very high for a while. It seems to have fallen off a bit. You and I were talking about this offline, that there's a graph that I think James Cameron uses to show the adoption of any technology, or the acceptance, I should say, of any technology reaches a peak and then a trough and then comes up and kind of plateaus out. Do you think that, where are we on that curve with the current implementation of 3D?
That's right. I'm sorry I don't have the correct name of the original psychologist who put it together, but I'm sure someone will know. But
I tried to find it before the show. I couldn't. I didn't spend a lot of time at it, but.
But there is kind of the euphoria of the new thing. And yes. Then, you know, we kind of get over that and it dips down into, you know, depends how depressed you get. But you get over the initial, you know, think of it, it's, you know, Christmas when you're a kid, you know, you're the excitement of unwrapping your presents. And then, you know, hours later, maybe the disillusionment, you know, that it's all kind of, you know, the newness has gone. But then it does come back up and level off if it's good enough. So that's always the question. You know, 3D in the past, especially if you look in the 50s boom, it really only lasted 18 months was the real kind of peak. And it did kind of taper out over the next year or two, but it was actually very short. So I think we're probably, we've dipped down into the more normalizing aspect of people getting used to 3D. So no one goes to a 3D movie just because it's 3D anymore. Everyone has kind of seen it, done it. So mm-hmm. now we're expected to provide something genuinely beneficial in 3D, which is good. You know, we've got past the gimmick side of it, and now we're getting into the meat of what's actually good spatial storytelling. So I think we're, you know, I don't know whether we're still on the way down, we're at the bottom. It's like the housing market. Who can tell? You
know? Who can tell?
We're certainly somewhere on the leveling off stage.
Well, I certainly do prefer 3D movies that don't use the gimmick shots, right? With the things poking you in the eye or the golf ball coming at you. I thought Avatar was generally pretty good, except for the one shot where the corporate guy is putting on the little, and the golf ball's coming towards the audience. And I'm going, oh, come on, that's gimmick central. Yeah. How is it that 3D can really be used to enhance the story as opposed to just being a gimmick?
Yeah, I mean, I think the whole point of going to the movies is to try and transport you into another world. And certainly, yep. I mean, the first half of Avatar, you know, the discovery of the planet and that, you know, arriving into the jungle and walking around, the sense of being there was so strong when I woke up the next day. I really did feel like a, you know, that feeling of like you've been on vacation, but did it really happen? Because now you're back at work or whatever.
Right.
You know, I certainly had that feeling about Avatar in a way that I hadn't got from a 2D movie. And it did very much remind me of that first experience as a kid, you know, of looking at the black and white World War II pictures. So partly, you know, 2D filmmaking techniques, and, you know, we're guilty of it here at DreamWorks as well, of, you know, fast cutting and, you know, that kind of high-paced animation especially doesn't mm-hmm. necessarily make for the best spatial involvement. And so we're in a strange situation where we're still having to deliver a really excellent 2D movie experience and a really excellent 3D movie experience, but from the same content. And so they do pull against each other and really want to go in different places sometimes. Mm. So I think in general, slower cuts and more complex scenes work better in 3D, and probably why Avatar's jungle sequence looked especially good, because the complexity that you can get from a 2D movie is much lower than the complexity that your brain can easily understand stereoscopically. Mm. And actually, one of my little test pictures, which I show as an intro to 3D all the time, is just a shot looking up at a tree full of leaves, which is close. And in 2D, you can't really make any sense of the shot. It's just a whole load of green shapes, you know. But when you see that stereoscopically, you instantly understand the shape of the leaves and the space between them and where the branches are. And it's actually a very interesting shot in stereo and a very boring, confusing shot in 2D. And so I think we actually need to make visually much more complex shots with much more stuff in them, more stuff the better, but have the duration be longer and have the action more flowing within that.
Mm-hmm. F-Loop in the chat room asks, where are directors on the learning curve for 3D use? Generally speaking. Do you anticipate a time when directors and cinematographers will be savvy enough to just know what they're doing?
Sure. I mean, it's definitely new, because if you think about anyone who's an experienced director has probably invested 20, 30 years of their lives working towards their expert understanding of 2D storytelling. So, I mean, I do have this sort of sarcastic, jokey phrase, which is directors and cinematographers are the world's experts at 3D to 2D conversion.
And, you know, very good.
That may not be the ideal starting point, But, you know, some directors are very open and excited about the new possibility. And other directors are quite anxious about, you know, what they understand. Is it still valid? And so what we found the best way to get over that is to immediately take a sequence and take it through all the steps that we're going to go through into 3D and let them see it for themselves. I'm just going to take my headphones off and grab a piece of paper off my board here because it just reminded me. Hold on just a second.
Okay, sure. Sure. While he's doing that, I want to thank everybody in the chat room for posting questions. Got some great questions in here and also some very strong opinions, which is fine. That's great. I'm glad to have strong opinions.
You can say whatever you like because I can't see the chat room.
Yes, exactly. Loquacious points out, and I agree with him, Avatar wasn't a very good movie plot, 3D or not. I have to agree. I did not think the movie itself was very good. But as a demonstration of what you can do with 3D, I think it was fabulous.
Yeah. And the piece of paper I grabbed here was something I wrote a while ago, which was, you know, the five stages of grief that, you know, we hear about. It's like the five stages of a new stereo movie. And, you know, denial being the first one, you know, my project isn't in 3D. This was going back 5 years. Well, you know, at DreamWorks Animation, you skip that one because our boss, Jeffrey Katzenberg, you know, was very clear that it is going to be in 3D. And so get on board or kind of get out of
the way. He has said every movie from DreamWorks Animation from this point forward, from a year or two ago forward, was going to be in 3D.
That's right. So the other four steps I have are disturbance, bargaining, recognition, and innovation. And that's really, you know, disturbance is that point where what the directors were visualizing two-dimensionally is disturbed by adding space. And so it goes through this bargaining stage next of, you know, can we still do this in 3D? Could we turn the 3D down? Kind of trying to make it more like what they expected, maybe. And then there's always some shot that shows up somewhere. And on How to Train Your Dragon, it was, you know, diving down with the dragon across the sea, where Chris Saunders and Dean DeBlois, the two directors, in fact, Chris especially was like, wow, I didn't expect that shot to look that good. You know, and he was seeing it in 3D for the first time, having seen it in 2D many times in editorial or, you know, in other screenings. And so this recognition of, oh, 3D makes that better, is the point that we try to get to as soon as possible, because then the innovation is the, you know, recognition of what it can do, and let's do more of the stuff which is good, and you know, less of what doesn't work.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. Now, you mentioned How to Train Your Dragon. What are the other movies that you've worked on in 3D?
So for DreamWorks Animation, actually, the first one in 3D I worked on was when I was still up at Industrial Light and Magic, the George Lucas company. I was an animator there, finishing on War of the Worlds. And then Chicken Little came from Disney to be re-rendered, a kind of conversion, but using the geometry, original geometry, came to ILM. And that was really my start. And in between Chicken Little and coming to DreamWorks, I worked on Meet the Robinsons over at Disney as well. But DreamWorks has really been the dream place for working in 3D because of Jeffrey Katzenberg saying, we're not just going to apply 3D after the fact. It's going to be an integral part of making the movie. And so go out and discover what does it mean to create a movie in 3D from the beginning. And that's why it's been so exciting here. So from Monsters vs. Aliens, Shrek 4, Shrek Forever After, How to Train Your Dragon, Megamind, Puss in Boots, did I miss one? Kung Fu Panda 2, which Damon O'Byrne did a lot of the stereo on. And now we're looking at Madagascar 3 as kind of the hot one right now, which is coming out next. Guardians, which my other colleague Willem Dries is helping Damien with the stereo on again. So we're going out to Turbo beyond that. I'm not sure what's officially out there now. I think they're all publicly listed, but we have always about four movies in production at any time. And one is, you know, becoming the hot one because it's coming up for delivery, and the others are kind of cooking away out there down the line. So I know by the end of 2010, I think it was, when did Dragon come out? Yeah, we'd released Dragon and Shrek early on in the year. Megamind was at the end of the year. And in between, we actually did our own 3D conversions with mainly with Legend Films on Shrek 1, 2, and 3. So by the end of October, we'd gone through completion of 6 stereo movies, which was a pretty exhausting year. So I'm glad it's
timed sure.
down a little since then. So, but there's a lot on TV specials as well. 20-minute TV specials and Blu-ray extras. We're doing them all stereoscopically.
Let's see. F-Loop asks, is the upcoming 3D drama The Great Gatsby important for wider adoption of 3D by traditional directors? Could this be one that accelerates or stunts wider adoption? I would also ask the same question about Hugo by Martin Scorsese. There's a major filmmaker who I believe that was probably his first 3D movie, if I'm not mistaken.
As I understand it, it was, yeah. I think the more we see directors like that trying to do something with 3D, the better it is, of course, because the more that's out there, the more everyone learns, and the quicker we'll get past the training wheel stage and onto something genuinely exciting. And so I think, having big directors or well-known directors taking on stereo is a huge bonus for us.
Well, I certainly did like Hugo. I enjoyed it a lot. I know Leo didn't. Our Grandpa Leo here, Papa Leo of the Twit Network, is not a big fan of 3D. I know that for sure, but I really enjoyed it, and as well as Tintin and all of the movies you made. I have to say the DreamWorks 3D generally looks fabulous. Megamind was one of my favorite movies. All of the ones you've made have been just great, so I thank you for all of them.
Well, thanks, Scott. Thanks for that, of course. But, I think it's true that we're in an environment where not only is it creatively involved, but technically we're have a very controlled environment that we can really work the stereo settings until we get it exactly how we want. And so, it's a unique situation, which I think is unrivaled at the moment in the world here at DreamWorks Animation.
Just a couple minutes on the different types of 3D technology. In the movies, in the theater, the commercial cinema, it's all passive. With passive polarization of two different types. IMAX uses linear polarization, Real D uses circular polarization. But at home, we have passive glasses and we have active glasses. And now at CES, did you go to CES this year?
Not this year.
Well, then you may have seen or not have seen Toshiba's Auto Stereoscopic, which is glasses-free 3D. And Toshiba did a nice thing actually this year, where they have a little camera mounted on the TV that finds where you are and sets the lenticular screen, the lenticular lens that makes the 3D without glasses possible, centers it on wherever you are rather than you having to be someplace. But once it finds you, you can't move around very much.
Right.
So what's your impression of the different of those three different things, active, passive, and auto stereo?
I mean, obviously, if we could snap our fingers, we would all want fantastic 3D without any kind of vision interference, apart from my own lenses,
Many people who wear glasses really don't like wearing another pair of glasses.
Sure. I mean, and that makes sense. I mean, I've always got my glasses on my head because I'm in dailies 5 times a day. But for a production environment, when we're actually making the movies, passive glasses work the best for us because we're dealing with not only I have a 3D TV over here, but I also have regular computer monitors. And so shutter glasses don't play well with a regular LCD because there's polarization issues that blank out the screen. So passive glasses are perfect for production environment, in my opinion. That's what I like the best. And because of that, I've got used to passive being how I view stereo. And so I personally like passive glasses and higher resolution TVs to get over the line interlace. You mentioned were coming out at CES as well, so that's a good thing. The shutter glasses have had huge improvements over the last year or two and are looking exceptionally good as well. And we had partnered with Samsung early on, and we were working directly with the Samsung engineers to show them how we want our content to look. And so Manny, one of our engineers here, was literally sending updates which were going into the updates for the TV and coming back into the releases for the public on updating the Samsung technology for 3D directly related to the work we were doing here. So that was great. I think glasses-free technology certainly getting better, and I've seen some very nice examples on single-person interfaces, whether that's like the Fuji W3 camera. Sorry, W2 or 3?
The small little LCD window or display on the back of the camera.
It's the stereoscopic camera. And also, I haven't seen the Toshiba laptop, but I've seen a demonstration of eye tracking a laptop screen that once it found your eyes, without glasses, there was excellent stereo content. So I think we'll certainly get there with eye tracking because, it's obvious, but I'll say it, that you have to get a unique left eye image to the left eye and a right eye image to the right eye. And that's why we need some kind of system to make sure the light only is seen by the appropriate eye. Now, one thing I did see, which is very interesting about projection, we got an invite over to the company who makes the Red camera, which is currently being used by Peter Jackson to shoot The Hobbit. Mm-hmm. And they were showing us a prototype laser projector, which was very impressive. Now, it's still using glasses with polarized light, but the brightness was very bright. It was a single head projector with two laser light engines inside, whatever they would be technically. So it was able to shine polarized light out through the lens without having an additional filter on top of the lens because the laser light is pre-polarized. And so that was very impressive. And what was shockingly impressive is that the laser unit was just plugged into like a regular, Radio Shack power strip that, normally these cinema projectors have their own air conditioning systems because that, they're using so much power.
Plugged into 220 or whatever,
And this was just like plugged into a power strip. And, that type of technology is under development where the laser light engines, you can just stack up multiple light blocks to increase the brightness to whatever screen size you need and plug it all into the projector head. So I think we're going to see some interesting things from Red, I would hope, based on what I saw there.
I have to contact them and go try and see if I can see this.
Yeah, and I think I'd have to check my facts, but I'm pretty sure their server was playing up to 5K stereo up to 100 and something frames per second. Very impressive data compression and handling as well. So, very exciting stuff.
Yeah, in fact, that RedRay server, I believe, is what you're talking about.
That's right.
Is a candidate, anyway, I've heard, for delivery, a consumer version of that, for delivery of 4K material to the home.
Right. It makes sense. And it looks like the type of server that could be used to play something like The Hobbit if they want to release it as 4K stereo at 48 frames per second, which, of course, is double the normal frame rate for movies. So we'll see how that all works out in the next year.
I sure hope to see 48 frames per second become more popular and able to be done in commercial cinema, because that's certainly one of the problems of filmmaking up till now over the last 100 years. 24 frames per second, you just can't avoid motion blur with fast motion.
That's right. And again, it's something we've got used to as the look of film or the look of movies, which maybe, will create another round of great hatred.
Well, we're coming to the end of the hour.
I wonder if
there's enough time to go see a little bit around the campus just for a couple minutes.
I will pick it up and we'll go and see if it stays connected. I'll turn my camera the other way around. You can see a little bit of my office. There's a couple of 3D TVs there. And, so we are currently in the layout department. It's going to go dark till we get outside, but all the artists here are either TDs working on various movies or they're artists who are setting up shots. So
they're working on computers, obviously.
Don't look.
Uh-oh.
And move fast so that you can't see any pictures.
Oh, that's right. We don't want to break any copyright here. This could be a problem.
So the current movies under production are Turbo, about a racing snail, and Guardians, which are looking at characters fairy tale, like.
We might have lost sync there. Well, while we wait to get him back, I will try to wrap up here a little bit because we are, in fact, pushing our boundaries, and it's time for TNT. So doggone it. I was hoping to get a little, have a little look around the DreamWorks campus. I've been there actually, and it's a beautiful campus. Oh man. If one has to go to work, that's a good place to go to work. If we've lost Phil McNally, I want to thank him very much for being on the show. Fascinating conversation. You can of course find out all about his work at dreamworksanimation.com. And you can find me online, of course, at hometheater.com. You can email me at scott@twit.tv with questions or suggestions for future guests. And you can follow me on Twitter at htgeekscott. Next week, my guest geek is scheduled to be Diego Stocco, a sound designer and multi-channel audio expert that I met at CES this year. I actually met him last year also, but made a reacquaintance at CES this year. And he's a fascinating guy who makes music out of just about anything. And so I'm looking forward to talking with him, and I sure hope you'll join me for that. Until then, geek out.